You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Tonight is a night for those who love the writing life, for those who love books and ideas. This is a night to really celebrate ideas. Our author tonight is Sarah Bakewell, known for her unconventional bestseller, How to Live, A Life of Montaigne, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Biography. Sarah is a former bookseller and a curator of early printed books. She now teaches in the Masters of Studies in Creative Writing at Kellogg College at the University of Oxford, and she comes to us from London. I loved Sarah's biography of Montaigne, the philosopher Nick Hornby called the James Brown of the 1580s. In her new and eagerly anticipated new book, At the Existentialist Cafe, Sarah Bakewell applies a similar brilliant biographical approach to philosophers of the 20th century, addressing the enduring concerns of all humans. How do we live authentic, free, and ethical lives? That is why, she writes, quote, when reading Sartre on freedom, de Beauvoir on the subtle mechanisms of oppression, Kierkegaard on anxiety, Camus on rebellion, Heidegger on technology, and Merleau-Ponty on cognitive science, one sometimes feels one is reading the latest news. In her spirited account of one of the 20th century's major intellectual movements and the revolutionary thinkers who came to shape it, Sarah Bakewell offers a testament to the truth that philosophy still has so much to say about real life, about today. And in conversation with Sarah tonight is David L. Ulan, until very recently the book critic and before that the book editor of the Los Angeles Times. David is the author, most recently, of Sidewalking, Coming to Terms with Los Angeles, and he'll be discussing that book with memoirist Vivian Gornick later this spring at Aloud. He's the author or editor of 8 previous books, including The Lost Art of Reading, Why Books Matter in a Distracted Time. So as we listen to Sarah and David tonight, let's all imagine that we're sitting around a small cafe table at the Bec de Gaz bar on the Rue de Montparnasse in Paris, sipping their specialty, an apricot cocktail. I wish I could offer you one, but you'll have to use your imagination. But I think we're very lucky to be here in time and space as well. Please welcome Sarah Bakewell and David L. Ulan.
All right, it's a good thing I brought the fake Galois. These are chocolate cigarettes for the book. We may break those out. Thank you for talking to me about this. I want to start by asking about if there is. I mean, I'm a great fan of this book and a great fan of the Montaigne book, and I'm wondering if there is any in your kind of intellectual life. Is there a connection between those two? I mean, at what point did you start thinking about writing this book? Did it grow out of some of, I mean, because some of the, many of the concerns of an authentic life, of an authentic mind, are overlap.
Yeah, there were a few connections between them, some just accidental in a way, because while I was researching the Montaigne book, I read an essay about Montaigne by Merleau-Ponty, who's mm-hmm. one of the philosophers in here, and that kind of it reminded me just how much I used to love that stuff, and it sent me back to reading more of it. But in a more sort of profound way, I suppose, you know, there are connections between them which are not particularly obvious at first sight, but which kind of I began to find really interesting as I went on with it. I mean, I think the bottom line is that both Montaigne and most of these were philosophers or thinkers or essayists or whatever who wrote about life, you know, human life, what it is to lead a human life, and about experience, how we experience the world, how the world sort of comes to us, how our experiences change as we go through life. I mean, this was one of Montaigne's favourite themes was, his great final essay in the collection of the essays is called Of Experience, and it's this weird sort of seems very rambling when it talks about whether he likes radishes and, you know, he went off them and then he went back onto them again. He liked red wine, then he liked white wine. And he sort of goes on like this for pages, and gradually it builds up to becoming this incredible reflection on his entire experience of the world and who he is and what he values. And you know, it's one of his most extraordinary pieces of writing. And you could sort of see the existentialists, quite a few of them, as devoting themselves to that pursuit, because they write about, what it is to, some of them just write about what it is to do something simple like picking up a cup, picking up an apricot cocktail, say,
you can make philosophy out of this, smoking
a chocolate cigarette. And it's all subject for philosophy, and that's the spirit that Montaigne shares as well. It's, you know, anything goes, anything is a subject suitable for thinking about. I mean, the big difference that immediately comes to mind is that the existentialist talked about things like anguish, anxiety, and all of this, and you don't find a lot of that in Montaigne. He wasn't especially anguished most of the time. He just
right, and also, I mean, you know, there is that sense of Montaigne as the first modern thinker in a certain way, in terms of the way, the play of his mind on experience, and in fact, actually the play of his mind on experience in the act of writing and in the form of writing. But anxiety is very much a kind of, I guess it's not completely contemporary, but very much a kind of construct of modern life.
Well, it becomes theorized. It becomes a topic of philosophical investigation with Kierkegaard in the 19th right. century, and the 20th century existentialists picked up on that, seeing it as he had, seeing it as a kind of inevitable result of freedom. If we're free mm-hmm. to decide what kind of beings we're going to be and to choose our lives, then that is bound to come with a certain burden of, you can't just sort of sit back and just accept that you are a certain way. You have to think about it. You have to choose what to do. And, you know, that's a bit unnerving. So, I mean, on the simplest level, that's where anxiety comes into an existentialist discussion of freedom.
Right. Free will is very anxiety producing, right? We want, you know, in some ways, it's true, right? I mean, you know, in some ways, I often think it's almost like we want freedom from choice rather than freedom of choice, because freedom of choice implies a lot of responsibility.
Well, there's so many ways of convincing ourselves that we don't have as much freedom as we do. And Sartre is brilliant on that. He calls it bad faith.
Yeah.
It's all the little performances that we do to ourselves, or the excuses that we make to ourselves, or the things that we sort of take on as a form of pretense to convince ourselves that we can't do anything about it. It's just the way things are, or that we are a certain particular kind of person, and we're just that. We're totally defined by that. I mean, the example, quite a famous one that he gives to illustrate that form of bad faith is a waiter. And of course, sitting around in cafes all day, the Parisian cafe waiter, who's a very grand creature, sort of type of person, is, you know, very dignified, very graceful, and very sort of beautifully dressed, and walks around with his silver tray held aloft and sort of six glasses all perfectly balanced on that as he weaves his way through the crowd. All of this for Sartre is an incredible performance. And you ask, well, what role is the waiter playing? He's playing the role of being a waiter mm-hmm. and playing it to perfection. And Sartre is saying, well, really, that's kind of what we all do all the time, is to pretend to be simply this certain well-defined kind of being, rather than realizing that, like all human beings, we are free to decide what kind of being we're going to be by how we... So he's not saying, well, the waiter is free not to be a waiter. Well, he is free not to be a waiter. Okay. But he's saying that the waiter can never completely fill the role of simply being a waiter, because he is also a human being, and therefore a much more complex and free being than this ideal image of the perfect waiter.
Yeah, the example from the book, which I've thought about every morning since I read it, and will I think about every morning, is the idea that you are making a choice to not turn off your alarm clock and go back to sleep. You know, that everything is a choice in that way. It's not a requirement. It's not a responsibility. It's you choose how you want to engage.
I mean, you can choose Sartre uses the alarm clock. Yeah. That's his, you know, that's not me. Yeah. He uses the alarm clock example and says, you know, you can decide not to go to work and right. Okay, you might lose your job, but it's basically, that is your choice every morning. And yet we don't, we act as the way he puts it is we act as though the bell of the alarm clock was sort of attached to our arms and legs and hauls us out of bed without us having anything to do about it. I must say, that's not always my reaction to an alarm clock. Mine's more like fumbling blindly on the edge of the thing, desperately trying to put it out.
I try to wake up 5 minutes before so I can turn it off and go back to sleep without feeling guilt. I wonder, there's a bunch of things I want to talk about. But let's start with this. I mean, one of the cases you make quite compellingly is the idea that existentialism, which most of us, I mean, one of my also sort of favorite accounts in here is the account of Norman Mailer's sense of existentialism, which is sort of, wing it, right? But that existentialism, which is kind of misunderstood in many ways or regarded as a highly intellectual or intellectualized philosophical pursuit, is really a philosophy of practical things or a philosophy of practicality. And I wonder if we can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, there's an image which existentialism has, which is the sitting sort of slumped over a cafe
Galois
table, Galois, yeah. Maybe staring into your either black coffee or red wine or, you know, and sort of too depressed really to do anything, just thinking and slumping. And it's really weird because certainly according to Sartre and Beauvoir's definition of it, that's the exact opposite of what existentialism is, because existentialism is about doing things, choosing to do things, deciding to do things and getting on with it and doing them. It's about action and involvements in the world and doing, not just doing whatever you please, but doing what you please doing what you do in a responsible manner that is taking into account the whole network of involvements out there and the demands of the world and the demands of other people. So it's really quite an activist philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, in the book, at the end of the book, you have a line where you say, ideas are interesting, but people... I'm paraphrasing badly, but basically, ideas are interesting, but people are more interesting.
No, I think that's almost a direct quote.
And,
you remember it better than I do.
And I'm curious, I mean, because this isn't... I mean, what I put it, it's an interesting hybrid of an approach in the sense that it is a book very much about the ideas. And very much about the development of the philosophy. You start with Kierkegaard. You kind of work us through a whole bunch of precedents. But also very much about the personalities. And so, you know, these relationships are both intellectual relationships. And I'm not just talking about Sartre and de Beauvoir. But they're intellectual relationships, but they're also personal relationships. Mm. And so let's start by talking about that idea of at what point did you always know that you were going to go in and look at this through the lens of the personalities, or was your first attraction to the personalities, to the ideas? How did the project evolve and take this shape?
When I started on this, it was definitely on the personalities and on biography. I'd come out of writing biographies, and that was what first drew me. But what first drew me to the philosophy many years ago when I studied philosophy at university mainly with an interest in some of these thinkers was not the biography at all. And that's why there's this sort of ideas are interesting, but people are more so. Then it was as if only the ideas existed as far as I was concerned. I really took very little interest in who the people were who produced the ideas. And I don't know, you know, partly... I think it was because I was very young and so I was so excited about ideas and passionately kind of into trying to understand them and writing about essays about them and you know, arguing about them with my friends in the pub late at night and, you know, getting more and more heated. And the lives never came up in any of that. So I think I didn't have much of a sense of history or much of a sense of sort of people's lives and how things develop. But later, having gone through sort of working more in fields of related to history and then becoming a biographer, my perspective completely shifted into a sort of not losing interest in the ideas, but becoming much more interested in how the ideas interrelated with the lives as individuals, but even more crucially, actually, with the way in which all of these thinkers interacted with each other, because so many of these ideas became what they were because they were all reading each other. A lot of them were arguing or talking or reading and responding to each other's work directly, others more indirectly, you know, relating to writers of the past and or writers in different countries. So the philosophers that who were in Germany had an enormous impact on philosophers who were in Paris, and then often sort of moving off in a completely different direction. So there was a lot of sort of taking an influence from one thinker and then rejecting it or reacting in a completely different way and going off at a tangent. And that is how ideas develop and how people interact, argue, fight, think, work out ideas, defend what they've written. And I mean, it's just, I find that such a fascinating process. And it's a process that really can't be separated from philosophy, from what philosophy is, at least for most philosophers. I mean, you've got sort of Wittgenstein sort of going off into the Norwegian silence and working by himself, but that's quite unusual. Most philosophers and most writers, to a greater or lesser extent, will work in conjunction with other people.
Or at least be influenced, yeah.
Yeah.
Part of an ongoing conversation.
Be engaged with what others are doing. And this lot certainly were, I mean, to an extent that is quite unusually marked.
Right. And I also think it's interesting because you do, I mean, I don't know, for me, when I first came upon these writers and thinkers, I was also young, and I think I was so in awe of them, I didn't want to imagine them as humans in a way. Or, I mean, I knew they were human beings, but I wanted to imagine them as somehow having achieved a level of clarity or achievement that, maybe I would aspire to, that they weren't the kind of muddy mess that I and everyone I knew was.
Whereas any prolonged reading of Sartre soon puts paid to that.
Now I take deep reassurance in the fact that they were as confused as all the rest of us in some way.
Yes, I mean, I find that quite sort of reassuring. And also, I also think it's quite healthy. I mean, it's true that some of, particularly Sartre's later work, but I mean, to some extent, quite a few of them, the work became, either it went in a sort of extreme direction or it just became, I mean, in Sartre's case, his books just got longer and longer and longer and more and unfinished because he had a great tendency not to finish things. So
another thing to like about him, I think.
Yeah, me too. there's something about it's because of his reason for not finishing things. And that's usually because by the time he got anywhere near the end of something, he'd either changed his analysis, become interested in something else, decided that it just wasn't working anymore, wanting to start something new. And, I think that's a sign of a great intellectual appetite, which he certainly had.
Yeah. Did you always know that you were, did you originally set out to write the book through the, it is a group biography in a certain sense, but it really is sort of built around the nucleus of Beauvoir and Sartre. So was that always sort of the sense of them as the kind of center and everybody spinning around them?
Well, not entirely, because it's a lot of the book also concerns the German phenomenologists who were a great influence on them. Heidegger is a major figure in the book.
Yes. And Husserl.
Hannah Arendt, Husserl, who's a phenomenologist. Hannah Arendt, Karl Jaspers played quite a significant role in it. And of course, other French philosophers who were Merleau-Ponty, for example, who plays an important part in the story and was friends with them,
right.
But was hardly, you could hardly say he was an existentialist. He was a kind of phenomenologist. So it's quite, in a sense, it's a group biography in that it's a biography about a load of people, but the connections between them were not necessarily, they were nothing like what you would get in a very closely knit group of geographically sort of collocated people who were all sitting in the same place at the same time. Mm-hmm. These are linked more by ideas, which is why I do have this sense of a cafe, the existentialist cafe being, but it's a sort of cafe, it's a virtual cafe, it's a cafe of the mind, because it's, you know, you would never, there was never a moment when all of these people were in the same room at the same time.
Right, but they work together. I mean, there are interesting areas of overlap. They publish magazines together, they work together.
Sartre and Beauvoir,
some of them did,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
they,
and Merleau-Ponty.
You know, they influenced each other and then ceased to influence each other. They had fallings out that were deeply philosophical and frankly political. Mm. And the other thing that I find fascinating about this, which when I was first reading this material when I was young, that had never occurred to me because, again, I thought it existed in some kind of vacuum, was how much they were living and thinking and writing in reaction to their times.
Yeah, yeah, very much so. And particularly Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir and Camus.
And Camus,
also, we haven't
yeah.
mentioned yet.
Yeah.
And Merleau-Ponty, who also wrote a lot yes. about politics. It was kind of hard not to, because the time in which they were writing was, you know, the story kind of kicks off in the early 1930s.
Right.
And then it takes us through into the 50s and 60s.
Right.
And I mean, there's also part of the story in Germany is an earlier period still, which is coming out of the First World War, which was a very traumatic period, well, everywhere, but particularly in Germany in the 20s. And in a sense, I mean, Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir didn't instantly become politicized. You know, they themselves, Beauvoir herself said in her memoirs that while, you know, all of the dramas were building up in Germany and Hitler was on the verge of coming to power and a new war seemed to be imminent, and they at that point mainly took an interest in things like the psychologically weird or gruesome murders that were happening in the local papers in Paris. And they loved reading these things for what it revealed about human nature. But that, at that point, they weren't really thinking politically. They were thinking in terms of personalities and psychology. But they became politicized through the 30s. And by the time the war broke out and the years of occupation in Paris went by and they emerged on the other side of that, they were intensely politicized. But they couldn't. They were very politicized, but they were never quite sure about what, or in what way, because they changed their political views several times and in all sorts of ways as the subsequent decade or so wore on. So they went from being quite passionately supportive of the idea of Soviet communism to being completely sort of rejecting it and moving away from it, and then Sartre became converted back to it again, and then sort of fell out with it after 1956 with the invasion of Hungary when, right, you know, right. really it was...
And there was also the moment where Camus said to him, because of something that he had written during the Korean War when it was unclear whether there might be war in Europe, Camus said, if the Russians invade, you have to get out.
Yeah, and that's a thing that is rarely remembered about Sartre, is that he was hated by the Communist Party for most of that time. He was regarded as a maverick, who, as you know, somebody who was of no use to the movement at all. Existentialism was totally unacceptable to the communist orthodoxy.
Bourgeois decadence, right?
Because it was bourgeois decadence. It was individualist,
right.
And it was completely based on freedom. So, I mean, that's not really a good start if you're going to be a communist. But on the other hand, it also... The Sartrean existentialism also, he became more and more... And Simone de Beauvoir too, more and more passionate about the fate of the working class, you know, the sort of the prospects of the work... Of a more egalitarian world. And they came out of the Second World War with an intense desire to try to do their bit to help create a better world. And I mean, considering what had been happening, it wasn't hard to see that the world could be improved, that there might be a better way of doing things than what had been happening over recent decades. And there was a tremendous fear of there being another war, both because, you know, Europe could be absolutely, I mean, it was in no condition to sort of think about another war. If there was a war between America and the Soviet Union, Europe would suffer terribly. But also, after all, I mean, in 1945, there were the atom bombs going off in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, after which both Sartre and Camus wrote articles saying, from now on, the human race, we have to know that we can destroy ourselves, and therefore we must decide every day to live. We must choose to live, you know, and this is like, it's a radically existentialist statement. It's an existentialist response to the terrible thing that had happened, because, and the terrible threat lying over the human race in the case of another war. Because, why existentialist? Because it's all about free choice. It's all about responsibility. It's like, for each and every one of us, we have to choose to survive, you know, that the human race will survive. I mean, it's an incredible thought, which we still are no closer to really taking right. on, I think.
Well, it's because, I mean, to me, it's the that sense that, right, what the atom bomb signifies is the collapse of all received verities, right? Everything we thought we could count
yeah.
on is now disposable or can be
broken
apart.
And also the traumas, everything that had happened in Europe
yes.
during the war, during the 30s and 40s, it all added up to the old sources of authority could no, they no longer had moral power. I mean, the state, clearly, you know, you're not going to put much trust in that, especially in France after the collaboration. And yeah. The church, well, that's sort of thrown into sort of a lot of shadow of suspicion in some cases, but also just particularly, you know, it's hard to have that, it's hard to have faith, you know, a lot of people sort of lost faith. And the family, you know, even the family, even the like bourgeois sort of family unit, and all the expectations that were both Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir particularly grew up with, this expectation that you would, you know, get married, have children, have a nice property, have a good job, and all of this just didn't seem to make a lot of sense. So on the one hand, there was a sense that everything had fallen to pieces, nothing could be relied on, but on the other hand, that everything was possible. Everything had to be reinvented. It wasn't just that you could do anything, I mean, you had to do something.
Well, in that construct, right, yeah. even following a traditional path becomes a kind of a choice, right?
Yeah, yeah, and a choice that was increasingly not so appealing, especially to the young,
right.
who, of course, had been, through the years of occupation in Paris, they'd been very sort of, on the simplest level, quite frustrated, because there was a curfew,
right.
you couldn't be out after a certain hour, you certainly couldn't dance to jazz, which was, you know, American music of black musicians, a lot of it, absolutely, you know, not accepted and not allowed.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly, and there were these kind of secret jazz clubs and these secret jazz fans, and they were called Zazus, who sort of would meet up during the war in each other's apartments and have a bit of a party. And then, of course, with the end of occupation, all of that just exploded on the left bank of Paris, and there were all the things that we think about, the kind of cellar clubs and smoky dives and bars and cafes filled with young people celebrating the freedom. And, I mean, one of the people very associated with that milieu has recently said, Anne-Marie Cazalis has recently said, if you were young in 1945, freedom meant also the freedom to go to bed at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Right, I think about that. And in ways, you know, that's an utterly identifiable statement, right? To anyone who's 20-year-old now or was 20 years old when I was 20 years old, I mean, that was also, right, one of the freedoms was to do that. That was one of the rare freedoms that we took entirely for granted. So the idea that you couldn't take that for granted and then it was presented to you is a kind of revolutionary notion.
Mm.
I want to talk a little bit, I want to come back to this question of sort of the sexiness of the existentialists or sort of the, you know, sexiness is probably the word.
Yeah,
we want.
That's a good one.
But before we go there, I want to talk a little bit about Sartre and Beauvoir's relationship. As you were saying, both of them were raised.
That sounds sexy
yeah,
as well.
Well, okay.
That's good. No, we're good. We're narrowing.
We'll slide into the scene. We may need these cigarettes. But I do think the idea of, you know, they were both raised as one would have been. He was born in 1905, she in 1908, so they would have been raised according to sort of bourgeois standards, and they both, in their own way, turned their back on those standards or rethought those standards. Beauvoir said, you know, she never wanted to have a family because she didn't want to replay her own fraught relationship with her mother. They were together, but they didn't live together. They had an open relationship. Their own relationship stopped being sexual at a certain point after
10
years or so. Let's talk about that, about that relationship and how that affected, the centrality of their thinking in some way, or their centrality as figures, but also how their thinking played off of each other. There's fascinating stuff in the book about their creative relationship.
Yeah, I mean, I'm quite fascinated by their relationship because it's often been written about from various negative points of view. You know, and of course there are things to be said about how they lived, but in my view, I think, well, I mean, one of the things that sometimes implied, at least if not said, is that somehow Simone de Beauvoir was a sort of victim in that, because Sartre was quite a serial seducer. You know, he had lots of affairs. She had fewer ones, but kind of more long-lasting and important ones, it often seems. Mm-hmm. And so there's this kind of, oh, you know, she can't have been happy. She must have been sort of just putting up with it because she was bullied into it, or she was, typical woman. She kind of allowed herself to be taken advantage of.
Or even for all of their so-called liberated thinking, it was, you know, mid-century, and they did end up falling into traditional, I'm not saying they did, but that sense of it, that those traditional roles.
Sort of subservient wife, right, and him being the husband who kind of makes all the decisions. And in fact, I don't think it was like that. I don't think it was as simple as that. And I think that really for her, it worked quite well. I think she got out of it what she really craved to a large extent, which was she had the partnership of the person that, you know, she felt offered her the most, or the deepest sort of relationship that she wanted. She had this absolute sort of bond which lasted for over 50 years, because they got together in 1929 and he died in 1980. So that's 50 years. I mean, that's a pretty successful relationship by anybody's standards. And but what it gave her the freedom that she also wanted with these other relationships. It gave her a constant sort of co-writer. I mean, one of the things I think about them is that it was so much a writer's relationship and a thinker's relationship. They always talked through their work together. They always read each other's work. They would be the first person to read and comment and make suggestions and be influenced. And, you know, there are pictures, you can see them. There's even little film clips of them sitting side by side at their desks and scribbling away. And that's what they did every day. If they were in the same city and not like one of them traveling somewhere, they would meet sort of for several hours at least every day and just sit side by side, either in an apartment or a cafe, to work. And that was, you know, work was central to their lives. Writing, literature, politics, all of those things were something that they worked on together, which is one reason why, you know, it's not surprising that there are many similarities in their thought, and so much so that there's never been, again, there was a certain tendency for a long time to see the real ideas as being Sartre's and her just being a kind of handmaiden that came along afterwards and swept up some of the details or sort of supplied the missing bits. And then in more recent times, that was so dramatically reversed as an interpretation that there were some who said, no, she was the one who devised it all, and he was the one who was just basically copying from her. And I think, well, I'm not convinced by either picture. I think that they were constantly working off each other's ideas. And that is the, as I say, this sense of the interaction between thinkers and writers is what runs through this whole story. And for me, theirs is the sort of paradigmatic relationship at the heart of that, because that was the foundation of it. More than sex, although they did initially have a sexual relationship, and they even talked about getting married and then decided that wasn't the way to go. And they decided very early on that they didn't want to not be free. They didn't want to get married. They also didn't want to demand sexual fidelity from each other. And that's, of course, has inspired lots of debate about why and what sort of... But one of the aspects of that that is... is just sort of obvious, really, is that it's a direct application of their philosophy of freedom. It's, you know, you can't, if you have a philosophy of freedom, for them that also meant living it out and living it out in their personal lives as much as they could. So they were, you know, they were pioneers. They were kind of trying a new way of living. They were trying to make it up for themselves and do things their own way. So
it very much, to me, infuses the second sex. I mean, the entire discussion of kind of women's identity or lack of identity, how women are conditioned, and you know, conditioned as young girls, women and sexuality, all of which you talk about in the book. And I, you know, having not read everything either of them has written, but enough. I mean, that book increasingly, I mean, I shouldn't even say increasingly, that book feels to me like maybe the masterpiece.
Yeah, it was it was definitely the most influential work of existentialism ever written, really, because it had such an incredible influence on many women's lives who read it. It was published in 1949.
And 52, throughout the 53, 50s,
and then translated. Yeah. And then it had an enormous impact here in America and Britain and many other places. It's interestingly the first translation that was done into English, airbrushed out quite a lot of the existentialist philosophy.
Right.
And it was partly the choice of the translator. I think it was partly the publisher kind of urged him to drop some of the philosophy bits, or to some bits were just translated in a way that slightly lost the point of the existentialist philosophy. So that did make a difference to how it was received. But in general, I mean, it was acclaimed as a pioneering work of feminism. But what wasn't so obvious to many of the people who read it was that its analysis of women's situation, both through history and as individual women growing up through a sort of typical female lifespan, was totally existentialist. I mean, it was all about freedom, but the way in which that freedom always has to interact with a situation and with the various forces that come into play, which can be historical forces, it can be, you know, the obviously class, race, sex, all of those, but the sex specifically was, as you say, a little girl growing up has, you know, she hears the same fairy tales, but those fairy tales emphasize the Sleeping Beauty or the princess who's right. sitting in a tower waiting to be rescued.
Right, either the victim or the...
Yeah, the sort of person who's waiting at home. And then, as Simone de Beauvoir says, of course, then the little girl kind of looks at her mother, who probably in those days is more likely to be staying at home all day while the father gets his briefcase and, you know, goes off to work. All of these subtle influences are constantly playing on the life of an individual. It affects both boys and girls. You know, it's everybody grows up with this mixture of influences, which we're always trying to kind of assert our freedom in relation to these many things that crowd in upon us to help to make us the kind of person that we become. But we are free, but at the same time, what she examines in that book is the way in which really those forces can sort of, it's almost like a sediment that builds up. It's something that becomes a part of what you are, and then it becomes much harder to change it, much harder to just simply kind of move away from it. Whereas Sartre had an idea of freedom and situation which was a little bit more just oppositional. You know, we're free, but the situation is whatever we find ourselves in. It's everything from the various biological parts of our makeup, we would say now kind of hormones, genes and whatnot, and our class and race and all of these things that make a difference to what our lives are like. All of that is part of our situation. Sartre acknowledges that as well. It's only in relation to things like that we can be free, because otherwise we would be just floating around in a void of infinite possibility.
Right.
Nothing would mean anything. Nothing would have any... There'd be no, like, leaping off point. Mm-hmm. But freedom is what we do when we leap off from the situation that we're in immediately now. But Simone de Beauvoir sort of develops that into a more, really much more. She talks a lot about ambiguity, the ambiguity of the human condition, which is that we're always trying to be free, but we can't, you know, we can't free ourselves from what we are. We have also become a certain sort of kind of thing because of our experiences. And she wrote an essay just before the, a couple of years before The Second Sex, called The Ethics of Ambiguity, which is quite fascinating. And that's beginning to attract more of an audience in recent times as well, after being ignored for many years.
I want to talk about all of them as writers a little bit. You know, as you say, they were consumed with the literary life. You know, all of them wrote in a variety of, or many of them wrote in a variety of forms, novels, plays, philosophical treatises, journalism, introductions, biographies. Sartre wrote, you know, sort of wrote a number of biographical treatments, sort of in the second part of his life, beginning with, I think, the Genet, with Saint Genet. You know, I think of Camus writing. I mean, philosophy is at the center of The Stranger or The Fall, but they are also narratives. I mean, they're writing in all of these. They're moving across forms, and I wanted to get a sense or get your sense of the importance of that, the literary life, right? Publishing magazines, being engaged in the daily life of the culture. We tend to think, I think, of philosophy as sort of people hanging back and thinking, but in fact, this is the opposite.
Yeah, it's very much so. And they sometimes used fictional works. Sartre especially used plays as well as novels and short stories to communicate his philosophy, but also for their own sake. I mean, I think he said in his memoir that what he always really wanted to be was a writer. It's almost as if the philosophy bit was a secondary for him, at least in the early stages.
It was the stuff he could get published.
Yeah, maybe that was it. Well, his first breakthrough was Nausea, which is a fantastic read, I think. I mean, it is just, it's an attempt to communicate the existentialist philosophy. But it's also, it's an absolutely kind of classic existentialist novel. The story of his character Antoine Roquentin, who drifts around in this sort of imaginary seaside town of Bouvie, trying to write a biography, but failing to do it because the man whose biography he's trying to write, he had all these adventures, but Roquentin starts thinking, well, you know, life is not adventures. Life is just, it's like just, and then he starts having these confrontations with being, which is a kind of naked blobs of being that seem to surround him. So instead
sort
of seeing,
he at various points loses his grip on specificity.
I mean, sometimes literally, because when he goes to touch something, like he'll sort of go and try and turn a doorknob, and even the doorknob feels sort of, like, what is this doorknob? You know, it doesn't feel right. It feels kind of doughy and blobby, and you know, he has these kind of strange perceptual distortions. His glass in the cafe, again, we're in a cafe, of course. He's sitting in a cafe, sort of looking at all the other people around him, seem quite ordinarily just laughing and talking and perfectly sure of who they are and what their lives are all about. And bourgeois, the word bourgeois is always sort of symbolizes this kind of person who knows exactly where they fit into society and what their role is. And whereas Roquentin, who's become disconnected from all of that, doesn't even, he looks at his glass and even the little sort of beer brewer's logo on the side of the glass doesn't make any sense. You know, nothing makes any sense. And he goes out and walks in a park and looks at the exposed root of a big, like, chestnut tree, which is all, like, he has a horror of this tree. And what he's confronting is the being, the brute being, the fact that things are just there and that his consciousness can't make any kind of sense out of it. And that sets him off to try and, you know, find ways of escape or ways of making sense. For me, I mean, that was my first introduction to the existentialist.
When you were a teenager.
Yeah, classic teenager, you know, picking up one of these books. I read Camus, The Stranger, and Myth of Sisyphus and things like that about the same time. But it was really Nausea that had the big impact on me. And I picked it up because I liked the cover. I had some birthday money from my grandmother, and I was in a bookshop thinking, what should I spend it on? And the cover of the UK edition at the time was this wonderful, it was a Salvador Dali painting featuring a dripping watch, and everything was all sort of sickly green. And on the back it said, that it was a novel of alienation and the mystery of being. And I thought, oh, that sounds like my
perfect,
kind of book.
Perfect, right?
And
yeah. I read it as a freshman in college, yeah. And I think it was the title. That title described my general existential condition.
Yeah, I mean, the title's brilliant. The great story about the title is that Sartre didn't think of the title Nausea himself. He was going to call it, originally he was going to call it Factum on Contingency. And when the publisher Gallimard accepted it, they said, oh, great novel. Might have to think about that title, though. And he tried various other options. One was something about the adventures of Antoine Roquentin, and then it would have a sort of a blurb on the back explaining the joke that, you know, adventures, but right. There are no adventures. And Gallimard was like, let's have a... And eventually it was the publisher who came up with the title Nausea, which is great. Great time, great improvement, I think.
So let's go back to the sexiness question in terms of the movement, right? I mean, or such as it is. I mean, one of the things I find about movements is that they're never actually movements, right?
Yeah, particularly not this one.
So, right, what Gregory Corso once said about the Beat Generation, four people do not a generation make. So, and
That's good, yeah.
Right, so same kind of idea. But there is this sense, the image of the existentialist, as you talk about, I mean, it's reflected in the title of the book, the idea of the cafe, the kind of brooding, smoking cigarettes, coffee or wine, you know, staying up late, listening to jazz, deeply, intensely engaged in a way that is somehow more authentic than the, you know, the bourgeois life going on, you know, the unthinking life going on outside. How much of that kind of social currency, let's say, do you think is responsible for the way these ideas took hold? Do you think that it was, I guess the relationship between the ideas on the one hand and the image on the other hand, that sort of, you know, it's almost like the rock and roll of philosophy, right?
Yeah, and it had a lot to do with the nature of the times, because this was the post-war generation, and it's this sense of liberation, a sense of particularly young people liberation. I mean, this is where you really start to see a youth culture emerging, and into the 50s that becomes even stronger. And it's, you know, it you can tell that it's really caught on when it reaches a place like England, where I come from. And you've got, you know, my mother remembers being taken by a rather dashing, sexy boyfriend that she had, who wore a black polo neck, black turtleneck sweater, and smoked Gauloises, and he took her to a coffee bar in Soho in London, which was where, that was where the existentialist, because you couldn't really get coffee, you couldn't get proper coffee in England at all at that point, but in Soho, it was a little Italy of its time, and the sort of Italian coffee bars, and that was the fashionable thing to do. But everybody there would be, you know, they'd have a copy of a novel by Camus or right. Sartre sticking out of their pocket, and smoking French cigarettes. And so it became, the style and the philosophy remained really very intertwined for a long time. And it was all about youth and rebellion. I mean, rebellion was the big thing. And then it sort of, as it goes on, obviously the rebellion, you know, rebellion spreads so much into the general culture. I mean, not rebellion in general, but this particular spirit of youthful rebellion associated with being able to do what you like, being able to stay out late, being able to listen to whatever music you like, and, you know, all the rest of it, that becomes pretty much sort of standard youth culture by the time you get to the 60s and the 50s and 60s. And so some of the initial appeal of existentialism, which had so much to do with that, begins to decline, because it's like, well, you don't need to read existentialist philosophers for that anymore. You can just go out and have a good time
right.
without needing a philosophical justification for it. But I think there's other aspects of existentialism that remained incredibly influential. Certainly this, the idea of freedom and responsibility for the wider world, and the need to be engaged in, you know, making things better or engaged in doing things that really matter, that remains incredibly influential for generations and still is, I think.
Do you think it's still, I mean, to what extent, I this is not an agenda question, but do you think it's still relevant, I mean, in the same way or in a similar way or in a kind of developmental way, that these, you know, it's easy to sort of say, oh, this is a an idea of its moment. You talk in the book at one point about, you know, he was, about Sartre talking about at a certain point he was already passé during his own lifetime and then sort of had to kind of keep trying to cycle back and find his place of relevance. What do you think the bigger relevance is, or do you think it's diminished in some sense?
I think it changes. I think it does change. And actually that, I mean, there was a remark attributed to, written by Milan Kundera in Czechoslovakia, as it was then, exactly about Sartre. This was in 1968, which was, of course, the Prague Spring and the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia, but also the May student demonstrations in France.
And he came out and spoke on this.
He came out and spoke. But by that stage, already among many philosophers, many people in France, Sartre was considered a little bit kind of past his best and passé. And Kundera said, is Sartre passé? Well, I've heard that said in France. But here, he's much more, he's got much more to offer us than the more fashionable newer philosophers that came along afterwards. And it's an interesting remark because you think, well, why? And it's because, you know, it's after all, that was a society in which freedom was under great threat. There'd been a sort of glimpse of a chance for more personal freedom and political freedom, and then it was brutally crushed. In that kind of situation, somebody who's writing about real human predicaments, about freedom, about taking responsibility for political changes or for your political situation, who's writing about, you know, even things like sex and jazz and all of this. I mean, that was much, much more relevant than sort of intellectual exercises, however sort of fun they might be. So that's a roundabout way of saying I think that the relevance of existentialism is always going to keep cycling back in different guises because those questions are always going to keep coming back, the questions of freedom, of oppression, of sort of who we are as people too, because another major aspect of what they were writing about, which touches on questions like authenticity, is, you know, what is it to be a human being? What is a human being? At a time when there's a certain tendency to, I mean, I'm thinking of all these kind of scientific, perfectly very interesting researches that are going on into whether we're really free, whether we can really decide to do anything, whether we have any control over the kind of person that we're going to be, because, you know, is it hormones? Is it genetics. Just sort of genetics? Is everything out of our control? If I decide to pick up this cup, did I really decide to do it, or had I already? Because, you know, if I'm wired up to neurological sensors, the initial move to do that pre-exists my feeling of choosing to do it.
Or any cognition, right?
Any cognition, and then, you know, anything like you think that you know, you decide what you're going to vote in an election. But some would say, well, no, that's all. You know, we can easily tabulate what kind of voter you're going to be. So there's a tremendous interesting things being said about the question of freedom, which also connects directly to the question of what kind of beings we are and whether our feeling of what we are, which is, you know, these sort of choosing active subjective entities, whether that's all some sort of an illusion or is it what we really are. So those are all existentialist questions. Well, they're certainly questions that look very interesting when you see them in an existentialist light. So I think there's lots of aspects of existentialist thought that are incredibly interesting to look at today, but not necessarily to sort of cut and paste bits of them and stick them onto our own 20th century experience, because that is, well, that's just, I mean, that's a kind of artificial process. You know, every idea, ideas grow out of their time, ideas develop in response to people's own time, and it's all, there's a much more subtle process going on than just being able to sort of pick and choose ideas and say, well, okay, it's time to revive existentialism.
Right.
I mean, I don't see it that way at all. I think it's not a kind of, not looking for a revival, but I think it's a very interesting time to go back and reread the existentialist authors and what they have to say. I mean, another topic where this, I think, is often pops into my mind, is the whole question of technology, of how technology interacts with our lives, how
Heidegger,
we interact with
Heidegger
our technology.
Wrote about technology.
Yeah,
in the 20s and 30s.
He did, and he wrote of technology that the first thing we have to ask is when we're trying to understand technology and its impact on us is not just to ask about the actual techniques themselves or about the technology itself, the devices, the equipment, or how it can be made faster or more efficient, or what it is, or how it works, or any of that. All of those questions really philosophically all come down to a question about what we are, because our own way of being is so mediated through our technology. And this is not new. I mean, that goes back to farm implements and beyond. We've always been technological creatures, but our relationship to our technology changes. And so, as Heidegger would say, our being in relation to our technology is always changing. And of course, he wrote that before. He was largely thinking about things like typewriters and old-fashioned cine projectors and telephones and combine harvesters out in the field. He had no inkling of the internet that was about to arrive, and which has possibly had a more radical and extraordinary effect on our being, our way of being, than any other technology in recent times. And we're still, we've barely begun. It moves so fast, we've barely begun to understand really how our constant interaction with internet technology, and everything that it brings. Our interaction with other people via the internet, our interaction with our own sort of narrativizing of our lives, with our own sense of who we are, the way in which we present ourselves in social media, the way in which technology gives a window into our lives on the part of these great corporations, and sort of all of these are thoroughly existentialist questions.
They are, yes. Well, thank you very much for having this conversation. I think we should turn it over to...
Thanks.
to these guys. We have... if you raise your hands, microphones will come around. So, okay.
Hi. Do you think there are any modern equivalents of the existential cafe where groups of minds come together? I guess the internet would be part of it, but anything similar to it?
Well, that's really interesting because, the first thing that comes to mind where that kind of interchange is gone absolutely kind of into a different dimension, literally, is via the internet. And but the other side of that is this awful image which I get, which I think when I think about the kind of internet cafe, if it was today, literally a cafe, would be that everybody would be sitting around looking at their smartphones instead of having a conversation. And that's one of the great puzzles of the internet today is exactly the fact that it opens up so many more possibilities for interaction, which are great and which we use. But, because of that, because it's so beguiling, because it offers so much, we sometimes are ignoring the people who are right next to, sitting at the same table. I think that it's... I mean, I don't take that gloomy a view of the internet, to be honest. I think that, we may be looking at the smartphones, but, it's not the end of the world. I mean, in between, we might have the odd conversation. I mean, just the fact that people come together to have this kind of discussion, it's not all is lost. I think it's sort of... I mean, one of the things that the internet actually makes possible is that there are... it sometimes makes it possible to meet other people who have the same interests as you. So there's things like meetup.com. I don't know if anybody sort of is... I think that... did that start in California somewhere? Or was it New... Anyway, it started... Yeah, or maybe it was New York, actually. But that's something where... It's internet mediated, but if you're interested in existentialist philosophy, you can start an existentialist philosophy meetup group in where you live, and then, sort of a dozen people might turn up and you can all sit around a cafe table and talk about existentialism. Well, you couldn't have done that, if the internet... So, I think there's a very positive side, and, I think discussion of that type is actually more alive and well, perhaps, than we give it credit for. Thanks.
Hi, thank you for coming and for talking to us. So you talked earlier about how there's this big disparity between the kind of, for the lack of a better word, bad rep that existentialism has of like just, you know, just like staring into your coffee and being depressed. And like, you know, what existentialism actually is. And I was wondering if you had any ideas about what gives us that disparity?
There are a few specific things that help to feed it. I mean, one of the things I think specifically here in America was that it came with this European, this sort of flavor of post-war Europe, and there's a kind of romantic sense of, you know, dark sort of little cafes, little sort of bars. I don't know, it had a sort of this slightly melancholy flavour that comes out of Paris at a certain era. That's one possible reason which had something to do with it. I think there's also the fact that, after all, you know, existentialists do talk about things like anguish or anxiety, depending on the translation. They talk about the difficulty of things, the difficulty of facing up to freedom, the difficulty of living well. And quite a lot of those aspects of existentialism go back to Kierkegaard, who's got a lot to answer for when it comes to the miserablest approach to things. And yet, I mean, I think there's other strands. And to me, it becomes really interesting when those aspects start to interact with, say, like this German phenomenology, which we didn't talk all that much about, so it's sort of as yet, but it's something that had a huge impact on the French existentialist. It's a different method for doing philosophy. It's something that's based on describing your experience as best you can, to sort of put it in a very simple way. So I think 20th century existentialism had so many forms, so many potential moods that you can find all of those things in it. I mean, there's plenty of anguish and despair if you're looking for it. But that is just one facet of it. And certainly is something that Sartre in particular, I think, would have found quite at odds with what he thought he was trying to do. So, yeah.
Well, thanks for coming. Was Heidegger proto-existentialist? And Husserl, and Heidegger was living along these guys, but never touched with them anymore.
Yeah, well, thanks for that question, because both Husserl and Heidegger, I mean, Heidegger could be regarded as an existentialist because he took his first starting point as being he talked about the existential analysis of Dasein, which was his word for human beings, basically. And he took as his starting point the human relationship with being. So, you know, you can see a much stronger link there. Husserl really wasn't. He was the creator of the method and approach that was phenomenology. What really interests me is how all of those ideas wove together and became an influence on the full-blown sort of 20th century existentialism. But it's also arguable. There's quite a lot of people in this book that are really phenomenologists rather than existentialists. I mean, Merleau-Ponty is another case of that. And I'm very interested in phenomenology. And part of the reason why this is called At the Existentialist Café rather than At the Existentialist and Phenomenological Café.
And Absurdist, we have to put in the Absurdist.
The Absurdist, yes. which would be Camus, yeah. Who was really neither an existentialist nor a phenomenologist. I just thought that I wouldn't be able to get away with that. My publishers would probably stop me from doing it, so I didn't even try. But I see all of those strands as being, they really do, they come together and they meet. They come from quite different sources. And it's the meeting point that fascinates me. But particularly, phenomenology as a method, which, as I say, it's based on description of experience as immediately given, is it's the strand that once that comes into the picture and mixes with this Kierkegaardian interest in freedom and individual existence, that's when you get a kind of, to me, you get an incredibly fertile encounter, which, you know, it kind of starts the story as far as I'm concerned. That was what I was interested in exploring. So, yeah, thanks.
Up there.
On the subject of their anxiety that you were talking about when they get to a certain point, have they ever mentioned any seeking any remedies for it? Or was it a real thing kind of debilitating them in their lives? Or, you know, did meditation ever come into the fray back then? Or was that too Eastern still? Or maybe it was have some chamomile tea instead of the black coffee at the cafe or something?
Yeah, it's interesting the way in which anxiety has been cast as a term, has been sort of cast in different eras. And it, for them, in various forms, they all approached it differently, but Kierkegaard, Heidegger also wrote a lot about anxiety, and Sartre. I don't think they would have seen it as being something that can be treated in any way or combated or sort of minimized, because it is part of the human condition. It is the existential problem. It's the inevitable result for Sartre and Kierkegaard. It's the inevitable result of confronting one's freedom. Well, it's the dizziness of freedom. It was Kierkegaard's word for it, which I think a term for where the anxiety comes from. It's like you're literally sort of looking into what the abyss of all of the possibilities of what you could do, and the abyss of your own freedom to choose what you're going to do. See, having said that, it's not gloomy. It now sounds starting to sound dreadful, isn't it? Well, maybe instead of looking down into an abyss, we should be sort of looking up into a great open blue sky. But either way, it's all open. It's all up to you. So the anxiety comes from a great literally existential or metaphysical unease in the face of what you could become, in the face of the fact that you can become whatever you choose. Having said that, there were remedies, not so much for anxiety. I mean, Sartre was certainly quite happy to experiment with different mental states, I suppose. He tried taking hallucinogens when it was not many people were doing that yet. He experimented in 1935. He tried taking mescaline, and it's some of the descriptions that he gives us in Nausea of, like, this doorknob that turned all blobby, I suspect had something to do with that, because he had flashbacks for years afterwards, horrible flashbacks in which lobsters were following him just outside the field of his vision, houses seemed to be looking at him with human faces, and it gradually wore off. But for a couple of years he was seriously troubled by that. What he later developed was an addiction to a drug called Corydron, which was a mixture of amphetamines and painkillers. So I don't think that would have done too much to help any anxiety. But where he took it because he wanted to get more and more and more work out of himself. He wasn't content with the number of hours a day that he was able to spend sitting at his cafe table writing.
But so then he drank on top of it.
And then he drank. They all drank a lot as well. At least he and Simone de Beauvoir both liked their drinks quite a lot. So there was. I mean, pharmacologically, it's what was going on in Sartre's body doesn't bear too much thinking about. Meditation, that's a very interesting possibility. I think it comes down to the fact that I think they would all have been interested in that sort of thing, but not have seen it as offering really a solution, because it's like, I guess this touches on the question of whether they were happy about it or not, because for them anxiety, because it was the response to the human condition, it was the way in which you can be free. For them, if you banish the anxiety, you've probably banished, somewhere along the line for them, that I think they would say you've probably banished your freedom, or you've at least tried to deny it, because we can't not be free. But it's the one thing that we're not free to do, is not to be free. But we can certainly disguise our freedom to ourselves. We can pretend not to be free. So, yeah. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much. I think we are out of time. So okay. Thank you to Sarah Bakewell.
Thanks very much. And thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. And
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.